So this is the fourth week in this session, this year, and we're going to be completing the time section, and then we'll move on. And I actually wanted to start by saying something about, I wanted to start by saying something about how we're going to continue, because the natural thing would be to move on to the knowledge section of dynamics, but we're not going to do that. Instead, I'm going to start a program in September, which will be going back into When It Rains as the basis for what we're doing. And it's going to be a systematic program that is intended partly as a teacher training program. So this is something I'm going to discuss with people on the retreat, and I'll be sending around some information, and I'll certainly say something in the orientation also. But the basic idea is that in September we'll start with a program that will run year-round, a little bit more intensively than we've been doing it. It will still be six-week sessions, but we'll do six sessions a year. So that means 36 weeks out of the year, and it'll run for 2 years. And people can take it in the same way that we've been doing this program. It's not a problem. There'll be a little bit more reading. Well, there will definitely be more reading than we've been doing. And if you go back and look at When It Rains, those of you who have it, you'll see that reading is drawn from all the different texts because it's meant to be an overview, an introduction of the whole TSK program. But I'm going to shorten the readings. We won't be doing all the readings because we actually tried this. Those of you who have been with us since the beginning of the online program may remember that in 2007, I think it was, when we started, I was originally going to use When It Rains as the foundation. And it just turned out to be too much material to cover. So there are 36 units in When It Rains. And originally I was going to do one unit each week. And that was just impossible. We saw immediately it was way too much material. And so then we changed it to one unit every 2 weeks. And that was still too much material. So in this program, we're going to do one unit every 2 weeks, but I'm going to reduce the readings. There'll be less to read. And hopefully that will work. And there'll be retreats as part of it. And so one of the things that's really exciting to me about that is that it will also be a teacher training program. And partly for that reason, we will have people joining from each of the Nyingma centers. I'm not quite sure how that will work. That's a question for the Nyingma Centers organization. But they're planning on having two people from each center. So that would be actually eight more people. And it's one reason I want to make sure the connection with Brazil works. So we would have eight more people joining us, some of them with some experience in TSK, some of them without so much experience, but we hope a certain affinity, a certain readiness to engage the TSK teachings. So there'll be more people online or more people listening, and I think that'll make it a more active group, and I think make the retreats pretty dynamic. It may mean I do more traveling to do retreats, you know, one in Europe and one in Brazil each year. I'm already planning on doing a retreat in England next summer. The end of August, I think, next summer. So those are some changes, and it'll be fun to see how that moves forward. So we'll have to save the knowledge section of dynamics for a later time. I have some other innovations in mind, but those will unfold over the course of the next couple of years, I hope. Okay, so yeah, okay. What I'm going to do, so we had a couple of questions here in the chat box. So David's looking forward to it, and that's good. Yeah, I am too. And Karin, you want to make sure you know when the retreats are going to be. And I can tell you, and I know your schedule only allows certain times, the first retreat that I'm planning is in June. I don't remember the exact dates. June of 2014, probably late June, but I don't remember for sure. But I will send around an outline that has all the dates. I've already worked out all the dates for 2 years, so I'm very proud of myself. Okay, so that's it. Let's get started with today because, as always, we have a lot of really wonderful material to cover. So I want to start by going back to a sentence that we talked about last time. It was in the reading for last time that seems to me very helpful in understanding what it is that we're trying to accomplish here. It's in the middle of page 158, and it says we're talking about time and how it reveals mystery. There's some feedback coming from call-in user 3, so Kathleen, I'm going to let you look into that. The paragraph, second full paragraph, starts off by saying that time's mystery can be fully revealed and still remain a mystery, that's a lovely idea, and we could work with it, but that's not what I want to do. I want to look at the sentence, a couple of sentences later, where it says, knowledge is honored in its appearing. Let's say that again. Knowledge is honored in its appearing without being reduced to something less than the unknown. And that's the notion that I want to start us with today to make sure that we really appreciate the significance of that. The point is that we have a way of knowing that is the kind of knowing that's allowed within a temporal order. And that form of knowing is limiting. And there's a kind of a feedback, you know, because our way of knowing is limited, our ability to understand time is limited. And because we have a limited understanding of time, it only allows a certain kind of limited knowledge. So that's the ordinary situation. That's where we start. What we're looking for is a kind of knowledge that stays just as rich as the unknown. And that's such a wonderful idea because usually we think of the unknown as being nothing. It's like zero. You know, if we go back to some of the space concepts we've worked with or space understanding we've worked with, you say, well, ordinarily we say, well, space is nothing at all. And, you know, totally boring, nothing going on. But it turns out that space has a wonderful richness and depth and the power of allowing. And that's what we try to explore when we look at space. So when we look at not knowing, there's a tendency to say the same thing. Well, if there's no knowing going on, then it's not interesting. It's not worthwhile. There's nothing of benefit. But the truth is that the field of not knowing is the field before the temporal order gets put in place, or another way of saying it is it's the field before limitations get put in place. So it's got this, you know, here I think it's fair to, even though Rinpoche doesn't use this word, to talk about infinity. And then the issue or what concerns us, what's interesting for us, is to be able to go from the infinity of not knowing to the finity, and that is a term that Rinpoche does use and that we looked at, to be able to go to the finity of the knowing that arises within the temporal order. And that's exactly what we ordinarily can't do. We find ourselves in a temporal order and we accept the truth of that order. We want to be able to stay within the temporal order, but at the same time, not to be limited by what it presents. You know, and the whole reading for today is about how to go about doing that. So this idea of looking for a knowing that goes, does not become limited as it unfolds within the temporal order. That's really what we're looking for. And that's why I wanted to call attention to that particular sentence. So when Rinpoche talks about that in this section, he's talking about the fundamental structures, and we're going to look at that in some detail in a couple of minutes. He's talking about the fundamental structures of the temporal order, which are things like cause and effect and the linear sequence of moments in time from past to present to future, and the whole structure of identity, which relies on that unfolding of linear time. Those are all the structures of the temporal order. But you know, once the order is in place, and it's always already in place, you know, we might be able to shift to a different order, but there's always a temporal order operating. So once that order is in place, then everything that shows up, and that means all of our experience, and everything, you know, sometimes we think about reality as not dependent on our experience, and that's true at one level, but not at another. But whatever shows up, you know, reality in the sense of, you know, the table, the chair, the desk, the clock, all of that stuff. All of that shares in the limitations that are an inherent part of the temporal order. And we've been looking at that limiting, the way that things get limited by the temporal order. And I think the basic point that we're working with and have been working with for a while now is that the limiting itself, the way in which the temporal order sets up an order and in doing that labels and identifies and puts things in their place, you could say. You know, it presents a way things are, and things can't be another way because that's the way that things are. All of that limiting is itself an activity of time. And the dynamic of time expresses itself in the I'm going to go back to the word finity, in the finity of possibilities that that show up as the temporal order. Or you could say, to go back to the language we were using earlier in the program, it shows up in the way that time, in the way that we conduct time. So the conducting, which gives us all of these limitations, is itself an activity of time. And so the point is, the, you know, the sort of fundamental insight that we're working with here is that if we understand the limitations that are imposed as a limiting, and here Rinpoche is going to talk about this in terms of this very interesting notion of alongsideness, and we'll get to that in a little bit. If we look at it that way, then it's not a limit at all. It's just an activity of time. And we say, so what are the activities of time? Well, you know, the sun rises and the sun sets, and you know, my beard grows, and we have this meeting once a week, and all these different things that we understand very obviously and automatically as time. But everything that shows up is a presentation of time's dynamic. And this key insight is that all of the limitations, wherever we look and we say, oh, here's something that restricts me, here's something that leads to frustration and unhappiness and a sense of incompleteness, all of that is also a presentation of time, is also an activity of time. And so if we don't take a stand within the temporal order, if we understand the temporal order as itself the dynamic of time, then we have the possibility of a knowing which is not less than the whole range of what is not known. That's what we're trying to look at. Now, I want to explore that first in terms of a term that Rinpoche introduces at the beginning of our reading today. So at the beginning of the reading, he brings back in a couple of terms that from earlier in the book, and those of you who did the space program last year had the opportunity to look at those. One of them is the field communique, and I'm not going to say anything about that in particular. It's just the presentation of the way things are. That's what gets communicated. And then he brings in the term ecnosis. It's an interesting term. We spent some time with it last year. It's a very interesting term. But for our purposes, it's not really any different from the turning inward that we've been exploring. The notion is that if we don't stay on the surface of time, if we don't accept the temporal order or temporal structure as the way things are, but instead learn to turn time inward or learn to, it's hard to say it the right way, but we rely on this inward turning. That's how we can, make sure that we don't take a stand within the temporal order, that we don't just automatically confirm the temporal order, which is what people ordinarily do. And ecnosis is really referring to the same thing. It's the turning inward. Ecnosis is technically described or defined as a turning inward outward, which suggests a level of knowing that comes in. But I think we already are working with that. So I don't think we need to think of ecnosis as anything separate. I'm just bringing it up now because he does use the term throughout the reading, but it is essentially the same thing that we've already been looking at. So in that discussion, what he says is, this is actually in the second sentence of our reading, he says, ecnosis departs from the surface, that is the surface of time, and its rhythms of friction. It's that word friction I want to talk about. So before I do that, let me just make sure, usually your people are fine about asking questions or writing their questions, but I just want to make sure that what I've been saying is clear. In some ways, it's just a summary of where we've been going, but it may, it's a different, somewhat different way of formulating it. So let me ask anything anybody would like to ask about that or say about that. Okay. I'm glad it's clear. We'll move on. Friction. Ecnosis departs from the surface and its rhythms of friction. Now, when I read that word in preparing for this class, I was struck by it. It's a term that is used in the TSK books, especially the later books. I see a question here from David, so let me go back to that. Ecnosis turning inward, including space with appearance. Well, I'm not sure I understand what you're asking. There is a question mark at the end of that, but I'm not sure I understand. But I'm going to take a shot at it, and if not, then let me know. When we stay on the surface, what we get is the temporal order. And the temporal order includes everything that appears, and certainly the space that lets it appear. There's a particular understanding of space which is active in the temporal order. So when we're looking in terms of time, the place we look is the temporal order. When we're looking in terms of space, we might look more in terms of self and world, or even subject and object. But the space, the starting point, you could say, is the temporal order. Maybe with time, you could say the field and the field. I mean, the space. I think I said that wrong. With time, the starting point is the temporal order. Let's just go with that. So yes, when you turn inward, what you're doing is you're turning away from an automatic acceptance of the way that things appear. So I'm just going to leave it at that. If that's not clear, David, or you would like to comment on that, feel free and we'll come back to it. But I was going to turn to the term friction. And what I was saying was that I looked up the term in the index to dynamics, and the first place that it's mentioned in the book is very early. In fact, it's mentioned in the preface, the Roman numeral pages. David's saying a wider perspective. Yeah, that's right. That's a spatial way of saying it, of course. So with time, maybe you'd say a more dynamic engagement, which comes from turning inward. and what that means, we'll have a chance to look at that a little bit more later. But I looked up friction in the way that it's described in the, it's actually called the introduction here. And the place that it shows up is on page 36, and so Roman numeral 36. And when I looked at it, I realized that it's actually very helpful. And it's one of these great examples where, you know, here we are at the introduction. Rinpoche is just giving a few basic ideas. But it turns out he's saying something very profound, even here in the introduction. So I wanted to read you a little bit of that because I think it will help us understand what we're doing. So it's the first full paragraph on page 36. Actually, I think I'm going to go to the second paragraph. He says, the possibility that time could present differently. And what differently means, that's what we've been exploring. The possibility that time could present differently transforms difficulties and obstacles, dissatisfaction, and even helplessness into indications that time is presenting in a specific way. So all of those things that he refers to there, difficulties, obstacles, dissatisfaction, helplessness, you could say that's the surface of the temporal order. That's, you know, and surface is a good word here because it's related to friction, certainly, which we'll get to in a moment, but also to the notion of linear time, a sense that things have been, we've lost some depth. So, okay. All of those things are indications that time is presenting in a specific way. We can explore inwardly how this happens. So this is a kind of a simple way of referring to what's later going to become this ekgnosis, or simply this turning inward, turning time inward. And then he says, perhaps the frictions that seem inherent in time's linear unfolding trace to the fact that time itself is being ignored or forgotten, lost in the press of events and the surface display of appearance. That speaks for itself, I think. In that case, we have a choice. We can try to cultivate the inward knowledge that will let us recover time. If we recall time to its place at the center of our being, its forgotten nature may disclose new possibilities for being and knowing. And that's just a wonderful summary statement of the things we've been exploring and some of the things that I was trying to suggest a little earlier today. And then he says something about how we might do that, which I think is very helpful. He says, there are situations when we seem to engage time directly, when we care deeply about what is happening to us or others, the quality of time itself appears to shift. So that's a question to explore. But that's the statement that he's making. The quality of time itself, the quality of time itself appears to shift. And the range of experiences we encounter may shift with it. And then he gives some other examples. There are times of faith or devotion, times of miracles, and times when the heart opens, moments of beauty, and unexpected epiphanies of perfection. And then he says, and this is very helpful, he says, the conventional view would speak of such times as signals of a change in our subjective experience. Always when I read this, I find after I've read it, I have to go back and reread it to get the point right. The conventional view would speak of such times, so times of caring, times when the heart opens, times of faith or devotion. The conventional view would speak of such times as signals of a change in our subjective experience. But this explanation is based on the unexamined view that objective time presents events in a way that is fixed and inalterable. If we conduct knowledge inward, that view can be challenged. So that's exactly what we're aiming at doing. And I think what's really helpful there is that Rinpoche contrasts that to our ordinary understanding. And everybody would agree that we have certain kinds of experiences that are special. And everybody would agree that time can manifest differently. Everybody says that. You know, they say, oh, you know, when time flies when you're having fun, or you know, when you're with someone you care about, the whole temporal flow of events seems different. Everybody understands that. At least I'm going to assume everybody understands that. And we have a way of explaining that. And the way we explain it is to say, well, that's just the subjective experience of time. Time is such and such. Time is clearly, you know, linear and relates to cause and effect and is past and present and future and so on and so forth. And then subjectively we experience it in a particular way. And saying it that way leaves out any possibility of a real transformation in our, I can't say experience of time, that's too subjective, in the way that time unfolds, or in the potential conducting of time. We're looking at the possibility that it could all be different. And so when we talk about friction, and I'm going to go back now to the material that we were working with for this chapter, for this session today, when we talk about friction, it's a marker, it's an indicator that we're talking about the ordinary temporal order, which always stays superficial like that, and at least in our temporal order, maybe you could imagine some other temporal order that would be different, but in our temporal order, time flows in a kind of a superficial way, and events show up one after another in this linear sequence, which is connected to the friction, connected to the superficiality. And we want to be able to look at it differently. So, you know, we'd like to be, I'm not going to talk about it now, but in that same section in the introduction that I was reading from, Rinpoche talks about, you know, the wish to explain how things unfold. Explanation is never going to work because explanation is on that same superficial level. It's a way of connecting things in terms of the temporal order. That's not what we're interested in. That's a perfect example of the kind of knowledge which is more limited than the field of not knowing, a kind of knowledge that you could say is not true to the finity of time. The alternative is to shift the quality of time. The alternative is to cultivate inward knowledge. And the alternative, and this is something that you know, we're not going to look at today so much, but it's very interesting to kind of carry with you. The alternative is to cultivate a quality of caring, because that already is a turning time inward. That's really worth exploring. Maybe on the retreat, we will look at that. So now let's go back to, let's see how we're doing on time. Let's go back to the reading. And I'm going to go through something maybe a little too quickly, but what can we do? I do want to have us practice with this. So I want to introduce an idea here, and then we'll practice with it. So if you look at the bottom of page 159, it's a paragraph where, as is always true in Rinpoche's discussions in TSK, it's possible to kind of move through it too quickly, or move through it quickly without thinking about it a lot, let's just say it that way. But if you think about it, there's a whole lot there. So he's talking about how we can use ekgnosis with the availability of ekgnosis, we can trace the substance and certainty of conventional experience. So what I want to do here is just look at how he describes conventional experience and then how you could work with that. So the first thing he says is conventional experience has substance and it has certainty. That's where we start. At that point, we're just on the surface, right? And he gives the example of the world that's given to us through sense perception. So that's the temporal order. That's the starting point. Ekgnosis is going to let us do something with that, is going to let us trace it to something deeper. So that's where he goes now. He says, we can trace the substance and certainty to the operation of certain temporal mechanisms. So the second level is that there are temporal mechanisms which give rise to what we ordinarily understand, to the substance and certainty of what we understand. And again, he gives some examples. He says, such as cause and effect, or the interaction between the mental and the physical. There's one that I would add, and then I think you've got, at some level, you've got a pretty complete picture. You've got cause and effect, the interaction of mental and physical, and I would say the interaction of self and world. When you put those together, I mean, those are the temporal mechanisms that give rise to the substance and certainty of conventional experience. And then he says something just in passing, but I want to bring it out. He says, instead of taking these mechanisms and the temporal structures they presuppose at face value, Ecnosis turns their presentation inward. So the part that he just hides almost in a little phrase here is you've got these temporal mechanisms, cause and effect, the mental and the physical, and so on, and those presuppose a temporal structure. So what is that temporal structure? That seems to be the deepest level that he addresses, at least in this paragraph. The temporal structure, the easy way to talk about that, is just linear time, the sequence of moments from past to present to future. The mechanisms that give us our ordinary substance and certainty, such as cause and effect and the rest, depend on the temporal structure of past, present, and future. And we might be able to expand that, but that's a perfectly good way of thinking about it. So we've got these three different levels, right? We've got what ordinarily appears, that's the surface, that's where friction operates. We've got temporal mechanisms that give rise to it, and those are mechanisms that we almost never think to challenge, such as cause and effect. And then we've got structures that those mechanisms presuppose. They wouldn't work without them. And those structures, the fundamental temporal structure, is the flow of moments from past to present to future. And what he's saying is that ecnosis lets you turn inward. You don't take all that for granted. You're going to find a way of investigating it. And so the interesting and important question is, how do you do that? So we keep looking at this question from different perspectives, and that's why you could say that's why why Rinpoche bothers to say things in these different ways, because every time he presents something, it gives us a new opportunity to look at it. It gives us a chance to investigate it, to inquire into it. And all of those forms of inquiry, in terms of what he's saying here, those are all examples of ecnosis, of turning knowledge, really, temporal knowledge, turning it inward. So he says, instead of taking these mechanisms and temporal structures at face value, ecnosis turns their presentation inward. And then the question is, how can we do that? And that gets us to the practice I'd like us to look at today, or work with today. And it's just moving on to the next sentence. So starting at the very top of 160, he says, as the present presents itself, ecnosis goes in the direction of its presentness. Now, I am assuming that that's not such an easy sentence to understand. And actually, when I was thinking about it, I started thinking that maybe in addition to presentness, or instead of presentness, you might want to talk about presentingness. But let's try to clarify it in a different way, because I don't think that in itself clarifies things. We're going to try to clarify this for a moment so that we can practice with it. Okay? So the way to clarify it, I think, is to look at the next paragraph, because he's saying ecnosis goes in the direction of the presentness of the present. Okay? And now in this next paragraph, he gives a little description of how ecnosis works. He says, ecnosis de-dimensionalizes time. And then he goes on, luckily for us, to say more about what that means. He collapses linearity into the unity of the nuclear. Now, we know what that means at some level because we've talked about nuclear time. If, you know, somebody just picked up the book at this point and started reading it, they'd probably close the book. They'd say, I can't, you know, this makes no sense whatsoever. But we have some sense that it's possible to collapse linear time into the unity of the nuclear. That's one description that Rinpoche gives. But he says something more than that. And he refers it back to the idea of temporal mechanisms that we were just looking at. He says, the temporal mechanisms that give order to appearance, so that's what we were just talking about, those temporal mechanisms appear alongside the things or events they purport to order. We can still speak of the usual mechanisms, but our statement will no longer carry weight. There was a little noise, so let me repeat that. Our statement will no longer carry weight or establish the actuality of the mechanism designated. And then he gives an analogy. He says it's like looking at a painting and analyzing the way that space appears in the painting. And that's a very useful analysis, potentially. You know, helps you to appreciate the painting. But in fact, the space that you're analyzing is just paint on canvas. There is no space in ordinary first-level terms. There is no space there. So that's the idea of de-dimensionalizing. You know, on the one hand, you're aware of the presentation or the dimensionality of the space in the painting. But on the other hand, you are also fully aware that there is no dimensionality there. Well, that's the analogy. Let's go back to the actual operations of time. We talk about de-dimensionalizing time, collapsing linearity. So the linearity is a part of it. But actually, the collapsing is all of these temporal mechanisms that we were talking about a few minutes ago. It's cause and effect. It's the relationship of the mental and the physical. It's the relationship of the self to its world. I added that one. Those three are the ones we're focusing on. We want to de-dimensionalize all of those. And what does that mean, to de-dimensionalize them? It means to take the structure, like cause and effect, and not see it as operating on this deeper level than what's influenced by cause and effect. And deeper level for us very often means a kind of an abstract level. We don't have a real experience of it. So if I drop a coin and it falls on the desk and makes a noise, I say, well, that's cause and effect. That's a demonstration of cause and effect. But really, you know, can we point to cause and effect? No, we can't. And Western philosophy has gotten excited about that at different times. There really is no way of experiencing cause and effect. It's a structure, and we say, well, it's this hidden structure, and we have to presuppose it in order to make sense of the temporal order. So it is the temporal mechanism, right? Without the mechanism of cause and effect, things can't work the way they do. So it's this hidden dimension. And the others are examples of that too. Rinpoche is saying here, let's take those dimensions and bring them alongside the things or events they purport to order. So you drop the coin and cause and effect is operating. Can we actually point to something and say there's cause and effect? Or can we prove cause and effect? No, I don't think we can. But what we can do is say, in the temporal order that I inhabit, cause and effect operates. And I can be aware of how cause and effect helps me to make sense of the events that unfold, that take place within the temporal order. And that's the basic method that Rinpoche is, it seems to me, suggesting here. He's saying, we can let the structures that we rely on show up. And that doesn't mean that they're not real. It means that we don't give them the same weight. That's specifically what he says here. He says, we can speak of the usual mechanisms, but our statement will no longer carry weight or establish the actuality of the mechanism. So what you're doing, you drop a coin, that's one level, and then you say, oh, cause and effect. That's just as present to our experience. That's what we want to try to do anyway. That's just as present to our experience as the dropping of the coin. So that's the practice. The practice is to let ekgnosis go in the direction of the presenting, the presentness, the presentingness. Mm-hmm. Whatever shows up has an underlying structure that depends on certain temporal mechanisms. We don't usually think about it. We don't think about cause and effect very much, for example. But all of those are present too. And so that's what I'd like to have us practice with, is for a couple of minutes, as usual, look at experience as it arises and just be sensitive. Don't try to pick them out. Don't try to label them or name them. That is probably not going to be helpful. But just try to be sensitive to all of the structures or mechanisms. Mechanisms really better, a better word, but maybe even deeper structure like linear time. Be sensitive to all of that operating in each moment of experience. If it wasn't operating, if the mechanism wasn't operating, if the temporal structure wasn't operating, the experience couldn't arise. And ekgnosis sees all of that at once, and that's why you can say it de-dimensionalizes it. It's all laid out there. It's similar to the notion that Rinpoche introduces in the space section about flattening space. Right? And it doesn't mean it becomes less rich. It means that it doesn't have the same claim. The temporal order isn't weighty, right? It isn't real. It's just part of what appears. That's what ekgnosis does. So let's give it a try. If you're not sure, as always, if you're not quite sure how to do that, see what happens if you let the mind entertain those possibilities. So we'll do that for just a couple of minutes, and then we'll allow for some comments. Okay? Okay, so let's come back together. Anybody who would like to speak up is welcome to, and anybody who would like to write some comments is welcome. Yes, Hilary. Yes. Right. Well, that's an interesting. Well, that's interesting, isn't it? I remember when I was in graduate school, I once developed this theory, but it was just a graduate student kind of theory that, you know, nature really intended for people to get farsighted because it let them see in different ways, you know. It sort of opened up new possibilities. So yeah, well, that's interesting, and it's you know, one of the things I love about doing these little kind of mini exercises we do is that something can open up in a very rich way just very quickly. Let's take a look at Michael, who is I see a demon typer because he typed quite a bit here. He says it's not possible to be inside a painting, because it contains no space that could host the living awareness of being alive there. The projections of linear time are, I'm guessing, similar. You can't inhabit them because they're a projecting with no space inside. However, unlike a painting, it is possible to enter the underlying inner time that paints these familiar projections and the mechanisms in operation to paint them. Or is it possible, since you have question marks? No, I'm not sure. I'll read it this way. It is possible to enter the underlying inner time that paints these familiar projections. And yeah, I think this notion of what's painted and what's painting is pretty similar. It's like saying, well, could we be in the experience of the artist painting the painting instead of what's there on the canvas? Okay. In terms of practice, if reality looks like a painting, do we imaginatively try to enter the fictitious space, or do we try to pull aside the canvas and catch the painter in the act of painting? Yeah, so you went pretty much in the same direction. There's a very famous analysis of a painting by Velasquez, I think it is. I can't remember now, but Foucault does this, and it's a painting in which the painter has painted himself painting, and then he's painted a mirror so that he has people looking at him painting and the subject, and it raises some of these questions that you're raising. But that's probably just a distraction. I think the point that you are making here is really interesting, and it also raises another point, which is, you know, paintings, after all, you know, are meant to evoke a different order. I mean, that's one way of talking about what paintings are for, right? We enter the space in front of a museum, in front of a painting in a museum, let's say, or wherever we see it, and we're inhabiting our ordinary temporal order, and then we let the painting work on us. This is not some big aesthetic theory. I'm trying to get us relate this back. And it changes something about our temporal order. So although it's true we can't enter the flat space of the painting can enter our temporal order and in doing so transform it. And that might be another way of thinking about this. I think it's kind of similar to Hayward's comment. It's not similar at all. But there is a point that where the two seem to join with each other. This sense of being able to move into a different dimension of experiencing because we're not giving the same weight or the same gravity, is another term that Rinpoche uses here sometimes, to the structure, the order that we ordinarily rely on. Okay. So I don't see any other comments except, Alan, I see you're checking to make sure things work. Would anybody like to say anything, or would you like to say, boy, I didn't know what the heck that was about? Would anybody like to say that? You can just type yes. That'll save you a lot of time. Okay, no, I see no comments coming up. Well, okay. So Karen says, doing the practice, I see myself telling stories, commenting. Good, I'm glad you make that point. One of the things that struck me in doing the practice just now is that it made me uneasy as I was sort of laying out the description that I kept pointing back towards cause and effect, because that's not ordinarily something we care about or think about that much. But everything that we think about, and you know, when you point towards stories and comments, that's a very important part of the everything that we think about. All of that is the temporal order that's upheld by the temporal mechanisms, or I guess I want to say something a little different. The temporal mechanisms that we might look at would include the mechanism of somebody being here telling a story. That too is a mechanism. And we want to be able to lay all those mechanisms out. We want to be able to de-dimensionalize the temporal order, because it's part of the order that it's got these layers, you know, the thing that causes and the thing that's caused, the explanation for what's going on, and then, of course, what's being explained. And we want to be able to give all those the same weight, which means giving them no particular weight at all. Okay, we're definitely out of time, so I'm going to stop there. I may have a little more to say about this in the orientation, and of course I encourage you to keep the discussion going, as they say, on the website, because these are really important and interesting things we're looking at. So we'll meet next week, and in the orientation I'll write a little more about the program that will be starting in September too. So thanks everybody. Bye-bye.